Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening on this Monday. And there, somebody finally said it. The question rumbling around in everyone's gut around the world, from the leaders of the recently NATO member Baltic states, certainly the fragile government in Ukraine has asked the question quietly. What of the people of Taiwan, though, Poland, South Korea? What nation will the U.S. go to war for to keep from disappearing? It is the question right there on the cover of the May 5th Economist magazine. What would America fight for? Well, while you contemplate that, we'll also have a close-up look at the unrest in Odessa, Ukraine this hour. We'll look at a plan for international cooperation bypassing nations and the United Nations, software engineers to the rescue. And we'll have a haunting story of a man whose nation vanished in basically a single night. An East German thinks about what happens when history literally wipes you and your country off the map. But first, we turn once again to former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh, with a question of U.S. commitments around the world. Ambassador, welcome.
My pleasure.
So how do we evaluate the question of what commitments that the U.S. has on paper are absolutely inviolate and which ones are a little shakier? In a sense, all of them are subject to the change of historical events, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the United States has obligations that it very strongly stands by, particularly take NATO. We've made it very clear that in Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all, something that's only been invoked after 9/11, which is why European troops are still in Afghanistan, even though it's very difficult. So we can change agreements, but the United States always lives up to its commitments, and it will do so here. There, with respect to Ukraine, it's not exactly clear from a military standpoint what those are, but they're very clear when it comes to NATO.
And if one of the NATO countries were to be embroiled in some sort of confrontation with Russia, I know you're a diplomat here, and this isn't perhaps the best question for you, but there's a whole infrastructure of how we managed that military confrontation with the Soviets that would have to be reexamined, reestablished. We can't send the U.S. volunteer army over to confront the Russian army anywhere. I don't care what letter of the law is in the NATO agreement, right?
Actually, no. I think with respect to a NATO member, which is essentially Western Europe and most of Eastern Europe, the Latvian nations are the only piece of the former Soviet territory that are part of NATO. We've had some partnerships with NATO and Georgia. Some people think that that's what's triggered this conflict in both places. I don't believe that. I think these would have happened regardless. I think our NATO relationship with them probably gave them pause. But if any country is attacked by Russia, if there's any territorial infringement, there is no diplomacy needed here to state the facts that we will defend that country with force if necessary. That's a pretty clear-cut NATO commitment. It was originally established after World War II to defend Western Europe against the Soviet Union, and it remains today to defend all NATO countries, there are 28 of them, from any incursion from the Soviet Union. The difference is that Ukraine is not a full NATO member, nor is Georgia. What the NATO countries have done, and very much led by the United States, is to reinforce Article 5, again, which says an attack on one is an attack on all. And that's why I think you will not see Russia go beyond the Ukraine into NATO.
And, you know, Ukraine, in some sense, is already, I mean, you're not going to say this, but on some level, Ukraine is already kind of in the Russian column at this point with the instability that's going on there. So let's put that aside for the moment. But to really defend Poland, don't you have to reengage the whole question of nuclear deterrence and all of that stuff that compensated for the fact that Russia has overwhelming numbers near its borders?
Well, I can't quite let the Ukraine note pass. I think Crimea is gone. I think the future of eastern Ukraine and the rest of Ukraine is very much up for debate. Right now, I don't see either Poland or the Latvian countries being threatened. But if you do, there is no doubt in my mind that you'll see troop movement, overfly exercises, the whole range of NATO exercises and partnerships play out. And of course, a lot of diplomacy. What Putin is trying to do here is very clear. He's been broadcasting this for some time. We saw the playbook in Georgia where he lopped off Abkhazia, claimed it was a separatist state, put Russian troops there, and then did the same thing in Ossetia in Georgia, which essentially lopped off the two portions of Georgia. And to this day, that remains a problem. And then he broadcast very clearly, only 2 weeks after the Olympics, of all things, this guy's got chutzpah, that he was going to take Crimea. And now he's saying the same thing about Eastern Ukraine. The playbook is he goes in, riles up the nationalists. It's kind of like what Slobodan Milosevic tried to do in Kosovo. And then sends in Russian troops under the guise of local militias that then take it and then rig some phony referendum. The U.S. and Europe are trying very hard to raise the cost to Putin of any such action. And unfortunately, Europe's sanctions are lagging behind where we'd like to see them. And I think it's up to Europe to step up to the plate now. That's easy for an American to say we're not dependent on Russian oil. But this crisis is going to go on for some time. We're looking at trying to distance the European dependence on Russian oil. We could perhaps become their exporters. They're trying to reverse the pipelines out of Russia that have supplied various countries in Europe to ship oil to Ukraine, in which case they would be much more independent, and to try and sanction Putin's inner circle to make it painful where they can't travel, they can't use their banks. And eventually, I think you'll see oil sanctions. If Eastern Ukraine goes, you'll see oil sanctions. So it's going to be a very rough road ahead.
Well, the bigger idea here, though, and it's one raised by The Economist magazine and elsewhere, is that, you know, whatever Putin's playbook means for him, it has certainly emboldened people all over the world to test, okay, what are the U.S. commitments here? What are the real ones, and what ones can't they actually deliver on?
We take our commitments very seriously, and I frankly don't see anywhere across the globe that people are questioning that. They know the United States stands by its commitments and will do so. We don't have military commitments with Ukraine. I find it very odd that some of the president's opponents want him to go around with bare chest and he'll be tough if he invades Mexico or something. I mean, it's quite, you know, last century, if not, you know, 18th century. This is, Putin keeps referring to Catherine the Great's reference to the new Russia from the, 200, 300 years ago. This is not the 21st century way. And I think you have to look, step back and say, what's really going on here? President Putin is deploying tactics that are ruthless, brutal, and ultimately will hurt not only the people of Ukraine, but Russia. Capital flight is fleeing. You'll see defections in his inner circle. The economy is going to be tanking. And he's been able to ride an oil boom, a commodities boom that has made he himself and his cohorts extremely wealthy. But the country's going to begin to tank. They've got a low birth rate. They're stopping immigration. People are leaving Russia. And that's ultimately going to be President Putin's legacy if he doesn't reverse course.
Similar arguments were made about the consequences for the nation of Iraq post the invasion of Iraq and the situation in Afghanistan, which you've already mentioned. Do you think America has the stomach politically for these kinds of commitments? Somewhere, is there a kind of squishiness post-Iraq and Afghanistan that whatever the president wants to do, the American people might not follow?
There absolutely is we're sick of these wars, get us home. The polls all show that we don't want America to be any more engaged in the world. And that's natural when you've had two wars, thousands of Americans killed, tens of thousands wounded, and trillions of dollars spent. And the question is, what did we get for it? Iraq's still very fragile. Afghanistan could slip back into the Taliban. I think we'll work out having a residual amount of troops in Afghanistan to demonstrate that commitment. And that's understandable. But no one is talking about invading with U.S. troops Ukraine. What we're looking for is U.S. leadership, not just in these crises, but in the challenges of the world. I call it the Jell-O factor. If the United States doesn't act, the world's response is Jell-O. You need strong U.S. leadership to set the tone and get others to follow us. And that's exactly what we're doing in Ukraine. The fact that President Biden's top advisor, Joe Biden, the vice president, was there, it was a huge signal that we're with you. We're trying to help push back on Putin. And our commitments on both Iraq and Afghanistan were very clear. We said we would pull our troops out at the end of 2011. We did just that. We said we'd stay and help rebuild the country. We're doing that. And I think you'll see the same in Afghanistan. But ultimately, we can only do so much. You can give people a path forward. And if they choose not to take it, that is not the fault of the United States. Our commitments are firm to Japan, to South Korea, to Europe. We stand by those commitments, so I don't quite see where people are worried that we're not fulfilling our commitments. I don't know of one that we haven't fulfilled fully. The question is, are we fatigued? Do we want to go into another Iraq or Afghanistan? Absolutely no. And this president has made it very clear that we are not going to be doing that, but we will lead in addressing these conflicts. We're leading on the trying to create prosperity around the globe with these trade agreements. Trying desperately to get some address on issues like the food crisis, the water crisis, the environmental crisis, the big issues that are not on the front page. When the United States takes a stance, we try to sort of set the stage for solving these problems. Unfortunately, our politics at home are a little bit broken, so that's difficult to do. But I'm actually quite confident that America will stand by its commitments. And this is not a Democrat or Republican thing. It's an American thing.
Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, thanks for the candid conversation.
My pleasure.